Welcome to The Romantic Side of Suspense with Sarah Hemmerker. In each episode, she'll talk with your favorite romantic suspense authors. They will take you behind the scenes of the writing process, giving excerpts from their writing, and share stories about their writing life.
Right Cross by Andrew Huff. First, he left the CIA. Then he left pastoral ministry. Now, John Cross has been imprisoned in one of Great Britain's most infamous prisons. Has he reached the end of his rope? Or is this another move in a dangerous spy game? Christine Lewis, United News Network's rising star television anchor, is determined to find out. But in pursuit of her answers, Christine finds herself at the center of a cyber-terrorist plot to alter the balance of power in the world. From the English coastline to the Rocky Mountains, John must partner with the CIA and MI6 in a race against the clock to stop the threat of nuclear war and save the lives of everyone he holds dear.
Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of The Romantic Side of Suspense. I'm your host, Sarah Hemmerker, and I'm so glad you joined me. Today I'm chatting with Andrew Huff. He's the author of the Shepherd Suspense series from Kriegel Publications, and we're going to talk a little bit about book three and a lot about writing. So welcome to my show, Andy.
Hey, Sarah. Thank you so much for having me.
So we were talking before we started recording that you write suspense with a little romance, I think would be more accurate than strictly romantic suspense. Would that be an apt way to describe your writing?
Yeah, and even then, sometimes, you know, we have to sort of put books into genres that they're closest to. And even calling it suspense, I think is fair. But I like to even go a little bit further and say they're more like action thrillers. And so that I feel like is a little bit better of a descriptor, because suspense, you can sometimes think it's more of a slower burn and, like, you know, murder mystery style, versus what my stories end up being, which is a lot more like a Mission Impossible film or like, you know, James Rowlands might be a comparable author. In the non-Christian market, where there's just a lot of action in addition to some of the thrills and suspense and mystery that is in the genre.
So, I know that you worked in the church media, entertainment industry, and worked on screenplays. So, do you kind of approach your writing and thinking of it in kind of movie terms? Then, do you kind of have that, you know, movie image in your mind as you're writing?
Yeah, so that's kind of the interesting just way that I got into writing novels is I, at an early age, and I'm saying early age being like 20s, I was really, really interested in filmmaking, but as a poor seminary student, you know, I can't make films, and so I was like, I need an outlet for my for these stories. And so what I did have was a computer with a word processor. And I was like, well, I'll just try writing a book. Because at that point, I kind of was like, you know, at least with a book, I could maybe try to sell the book or self-publish or do something like that. And it, when it's done, it's done. Like, there's no, you know, once you write a screenplay, like, it may never get made because nobody may ever see it because, you know, you're intending it to go beyond just the writing.
Right.
So when I started writing books, like, yeah, it's very much informed by what I'm seeing happen in the scene. So I may, and even so Shepherd Suspense is a great illustration of this. There are scenes that take place inside of the three novels that I've written in that series that really are almost scenes that played out as if they were a movie in advance of me writing it. To the point where I'm seeing the images, I'm seeing the characters, I'm seeing the situation play out. It's got a soundtrack to it. And then I take that and I then start diving into how do I turn that into a written, like a novel scene that someone's going to read, because that's a little bit different, obviously, than what you might do with a screenplay, because with a screenplay, you may go, oh, well, this person just does this. and you don't have to fill in a ton of detail because the intention is that someone is going to, or, you know, you're going to turn that, you're going to see what's happening as well as hear and experience. And so it's a little bit like taking a movie and then trying to describe it without, you know, being able to show it to anybody.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. I often think, especially of scenes that involved a fight or a rescue or a, you know, something along those lines. I'm often mm-hmm. kind of picturing it in my mind. I'm kind of going through, okay, so they do this and then that happens. And that doesn't make any sense. That would be, you know, really awkward
mm-hmm.
or just not work. Actually one of my, I have, as my listeners know, I have four kids and they're all teenagers now. And of course I'm not quite the shortest person in my house. I'm almost, so one of my sons is a little bit taller than me, and I was like, okay, so I had him, like, stand in the doorway. I needed to know, how can I pull him into the room if he's, like, our heroine trying to – anyway, he was very cooperative.
Yeah.
I said, I can't – it's the right – it's not working, right? It's not
– right,
something
yeah.
wasn't – I was like, no, that's not going to – I can't picture it. Okay, I need a – he thought
yeah.
it was a little weird, but, you know, he's 14, is still willing to, you know, let his poor old mother use him as a –
right.
illustration.
Yeah. Well, that's a great point just in terms of anybody who is, you know, dabbling in writing is it can actually be really fun. It's not just fun. It's also really helpful to physicalize your writing, right? Where,
mm-hmm.
You might be acting it out, or you might be, I know we talk about this with dialogue some in writers' workshops and everything, is saying the dialogue out loud to yourself, you know, or
yes.
having someone else say it out loud to you, or, you know, or whatever. Because even though it's on the page and the reader is ultimately going to be seeing it in their head, it's really, really helpful sometimes to hear it or to actually try to do something and realize, oh, well, that's not going to work.
Yes. Yeah. Because sometimes, and don't we do that when we're reading a book? You know,
oh,
sometimes
yeah.
I've read a book and I've gone, okay, this can't possibly happen.
Yeah,
did
right.
they actually look at a map? Because those places are really close together and it's not going to take them
yeah.
5 hours to get there. I mean,
right, yeah.
really it's not. Although the
yeah.
time I spend on 95 through Virginia, I wonder.
There you go, yeah.
that you can
well,
add like any amount of time.
yeah, well, that's a great example because I had some characters who leave my first novel is predominantly set in Virginia and central and then northern and I took that into account, the 95, like, okay, they're trying to get from one place to the other and it shouldn't take as long as it's going to take, but it's going to take long because I know the traffic
right.
that ends up piling up in that area, right? Which is a little more related to personal experience you know, and writing that into the novel, but it's the same sort of concept of really knowing what that's like, or at least trying your best approximation of it.
Yeah, and I love that. I mean, what did we do without the internet and Google Maps and Google Earth?
Yeah.
I mean, really, what did we do? Because, you know, I can't travel to wherever. I wish I could, but,
yeah,
you know, we
exactly.
have to write
yeah,
some. Yeah, but Google Maps especially, I think, has been so helpful when you – I tend to set my settings in real life. I am making up a town, but
mm-hmm.
it's, you know, based around a real setting, not
yeah.
all made up. But so I want to be accurate. So I'm like, okay, well, is there a park nearby they can run through? Well, I got to put them here if I want that.
Yeah.
So at least, you know, yes, you have to take that creative license because sometimes you need a one-way street to be two ways, okay? People will forgive you a little bit of that, but they
right.
won't forgive you if you're saying it's going to take, you know, from Richmond to Washington, D.C., it's going to take an hour. I mean,
yeah, right.
anyone who ever lives here, that might seem realistic to someone who lives in Kansas. Oh, yeah, sure, but... you know, anyone who ever lived in this area of Northern Virginia would go, no, 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 no.
Yeah, yeah.
Even with no traffic,
yeah.
not going to happen. So,
Right.
Yeah. So how do you keep yours realistic? Because obviously, I mean, you're not a trained mercenary CIA
agent,
right?
Yeah, CIA assassin. Yeah. Well, so obviously, reading a lot of so I do two things. One, reading, researching. I watch a lot of like I was going to mention this. One of the things I'll do is if I have my characters wanting to do something that seems rather outlandish in terms of a stunt, more often than not, I have found that, do you remember the show Mythbusters that was on, like, I think Discovery Channel?
Mm-hmm.
The Mythbusters may have tried it. So sometimes I will find, and for me, if they think it's at least plausible, then I'm good, you know, because that's
right.
The other thing is I do take a little bit of, it's sort of what you're saying, what you were saying about location, right, is you can take a little bit of creative license because people are used to that in fiction or in, if they're watching a film or so, you know, just an action film or whatever. There's a little bit of suspension of disbelief. I think the way that you earn that trust with a reader or even with, I think this would be true even if you were a filmmaker making a film, is only take those opportunities to take creative license when you've already done the homework and you've already done the work to set up the realistic nature of the world in the beginning. So my characters aren't going to be completely invincible and completely, you know, they're not going to win every single time, because then what's going to end up happening is when I need that moment, then it starts to feel a little more implausible because now, I mean, I have been, you know, it's an action thing and they do get out of situations, seemingly impossible situations all the time. So, you know, and then, but hopefully what I'm doing, or at least what I try to do as a writer, is earn that. Because I've done the work, I've done the research, I've set it in a realistic world. You know, it doesn't take them an hour to get from Richmond to DC because
right.
You know, I know. And so when my character does something rather close to, implausible, you're willing to accept it a little bit because, you know, I've done the other work. And I will say this, you mentioned the one-way street, you know, so you might have to make it a two-way street. One thing that I found in doing the research is it actually opens up so many more possibilities for the story that maybe I didn't even think of. And so I'll use that as an example. Like, maybe I'm researching an area and I'm like, oh, I need this to be a two-way street, but it's a one-way street. Well, now I'm like, well, wait, what would that do? You know, like, that might spin me into a new idea that I actually end up liking better. And so to a degree, I don't know if any other writers feel this. I know as creative people, sometimes it feels like if you put rules and restrictions around what you're doing creatively, that can stifle creativity. But I actually think the more that you have rules, the more that you have restrictions, the more that you need to research and get it right, it actually opens up the creative possibilities. Maybe because you learn something that you didn't know that then goes, oh, this gives me an idea.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's true, that sometimes when we think, how can we write in this parameter, these set of whatever rules they may be, it can give us a little bit more creative like that. I think about that when, you know, I read a good, you know, secular or non-Christian book, and they have gratuitous, you know, language in it, as one example. And, you know, a little of that I can handle. A lot of that, it just takes away from the story for me. And I just think, I feel like it was kind of lazy. Because the effect is just like, yeah, sure, people might talk like that, but do people really want to read all of that? I'm not sure that even people who are comfortable with that want to read that over and over and over again. And it just seems kind of a lazy way to show whatever they're trying to show, right? And there could be a more creative way to show that emotion, that thing. And sometimes people think, well, that's not realistic. Well, but it does, I think, help us to be stronger writers when we're like, okay, we're not taking the easy way and just having them curse a blue streak here, we're going to have them, you know, express their displeasure in another way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that can kind of, it can be challenging, but in a good way to kind of stretch our creativity.
Yeah, yeah. I had, with my writing, I've had, you know, some feedback about some elements feeling unrealistic, especially when it comes to the action scenes, because I'm wanting it to feel larger than life.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, a for instance would be, like, I had a slightly enhanced version of a stun gun that a character used, and, you know, some of the feedback I got was how unrealistic that was, because that's not how tasers work, you know, or whatever. I'm kind of using that as an example. I don't even remember if that was the exact situation. But the thing I was thinking about was, well, I don't, like, as a reader personally, if you made it incredibly realistic, like, let's take my CIA, you know, my CIA operative story. Well, the CIA doesn't do these type of missions. Like, a CIA analyst or an you know, they don't get involved in the action. They're just pushing paperwork all the time. And who wants to read a book about that?
Right.
You know? And so,
right.
There is, I think, an element of if you push too hard into the realism, then, yeah, it's just boring, or it feels lazy, or not lazy, but it just is like, well, yeah, okay. Like, I don't want to read that. I want to read the story that's a little more fantastical, that's a little more exciting, that's a little less realistic, to a degree, just because that's more entertaining.
Yes, yeah. We sometimes forget we are in the business of helping people have that a little bit of escapism and have it be real mm-hmm. enough when we're not writing fantasy or sci-fi, you know,
yeah.
to help them go, oh, yeah, okay, I can suspend my disbelief. I can go along because this is a great story. And it's really all about the story. If we can't create great, compelling characters, it doesn't matter what they do. Nobody's going to care.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's going to care.
Yeah. Well, let me turn it back on you, Sarah, for a second, because I would say the same applies. Now, yes, I write suspense with a dash of romance. But I would think the same applies in a full romantic suspense,
mm-hmm.
because you're not writing romance the way real, you know, in a realistic manner, in the sense of, you know, yeah, it takes a while for romance to blossom and for,
right.
you know, a couple to, you know, and like you're wanting to write a slightly enhanced version of that, because And I'm going to let you kind of speak to that, because doing it sort of a more normal way it might happen in real life would just be, like, not as exciting, maybe.
Right. I mean, it definitely is accelerated. And with romantic suspense, it's accelerated while somebody's trying to kill or hurt or, you know,
right.
somebody. So there is that,
which I don't
yeah.
know about you, but I haven't experienced that kind of romance in my life. Like, I haven't had anybody
no.
trying to kill me while I'm trying to...
fall in love
wife,
with them.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. No,
yeah.
I'm kind of glad it was hard enough, just a normal, you know, life. I can't
yeah.
imagine, you know, but then again, I don't, you know, with being a writer, I didn't have a profession that might lend itself to that, or I just didn't know enough
yeah.
bad people. So.
Right. Yeah.
I know nothing that anyone wants to know. I mean, you know,
yeah.
not rocket science here. So
yeah,
anyway, right. well, I'd love to talk further, but we are out of time. So thank you for being on my show.
Yeah, absolutely. This was fantastic. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to The Romantic Side of Suspense. I'm talking with Andrew Huff. He's the author of the Shepherd Suspense series. And stay tuned for an excerpt from the third and final book of the series, Right Cross.
Now an excerpt from Right Cross by Andrew Huff. Cappuccino for Beth. A short woman wearing a knit cap responded to the barista's call. Christine's gaze bounced around the large cafe, noting other patrons and decor, but her mind retained none of the information as she replayed her conversation with John over and over in her mind. None of it made sense. John had been so convinced of his newfound faith in Jesus Christ that he'd left the CIA, and eventually found himself as the pastor of a small community of believers in Mechanicsville, Virginia. He'd stepped down as the pastor of Rural Grove only after realizing he accepted the position too early in his new life, slowing down to focus on his own spiritual and personal growth. How had he put it?
"I need time to get to know the new John Cross."
It seemed the time spent only let the old John Cross back into his life. And yet, Christine couldn't help but ask questions. And not just why, but the entire spectrum of information-gathering questions at her disposal. None of the answers she sought regarded John's attack on Lakeman, but rather what she suspected to be the root cause of his actions, his denunciation of his transformed life. There it was, the nagging question in the back of her mind, the one she wouldn't be able to shake until she tracked down the answer. The one she'd chased in the car ride from the prison to the cafe where she was refueling for her trip back to the States. Was he completely gone? John's malevolent outburst lacked two important details. He neither directed his vitriol at her personally, nor made any specific denials of the Christian faith. Her mind burned under the weight of those two specifics. Maybe the answer was no, he wasn't completely lost. This was only a valley, and perhaps the end result of this experience would be John's ascent back to where he was when they'd parted in Texas. She would certainly pray for it. But then again, Christine closed her eyes from wandering about as the left side of her brain took over. Speculating about a revival in John's heart was fruitless. It didn't mean she wouldn't pray, but despite the lingering questions, she suspected the truth was standing right in front of her, as it was prone to do. The John she knew was gone. The one she'd never known was back. And as of right now, nothing would change that. "Flat white at the bar for Christine," announced a British voice. Her eyes fluttered open, and she raised her foot to take a step toward the counter. Her body froze. All questions concerning John faded into oblivion, leaving only a single thought behind. "I know her." The woman in the knit cap? No, not her. Christine dismissed each person in the cafe through process of elimination. None were familiar. It was someone else. Someone who just walked out the door. Ignoring the barista's second proclamation of her readied order, she headed for the exit. The coffee shop occupied the corner of a cute brick building, matching another on the opposite side of the patterned brick walkway. Pedestrians milled about freestanding vendor shops in front of her. To her right, the sun glistened off the glorious tip of Wakefield Cathedral's steeple. To her left, the walkway carried on past the pair of buildings, leading the way to a beautifully designed splash pad just off the major intersection of some of Wakefield's busiest roadways. There, walking away from her toward the recreational water display, was a woman, every feature of her covered by a long black coat. Every feature but her brunette hair. It flowed over the coat, bouncing ever so gently in the light afternoon breeze. Christine would recognize those locks anywhere. All her questions became moot. She narrowed her eyes and, with the command of the entire sidewalk, called out, "Gwen!" The name arrested the woman's gait. With caution, she turned until Christine's suspicion was confirmed. 20 yards away, with her hands buried in her pockets and resignation on her face, was CIA officer Gwen Sullivan. They stared at each other for a few seconds, the surrounding public indifferent to their sidewalk showdown, until Christine finally dug her hands into her hips and said, "He's back in, isn't he?"
Gwyn's sly smirk was the only answer she needed.
Thanks for listening to The Romantic Side of Suspense with Sarah Hammerker. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. You can sign up to receive notifications of upcoming podcasts and listen to previous editions at sarahhammerkerfiction.com.